Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Vow, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director of the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how you doing?
Doing well. Thank you, Jack. Doing very well.
It's a very contemplative kind of day.
Yeah.
We're those kinds of people where when it's sort of gray and diffused outside, it's just nice to sort of sit back and just sort of contemplate all the major questions of existence and so on and so forth.
Yes, or whether we should eat cereal for breakfast, things like that.
Or whether cake or pie is the most impressive of all desserts. Kirk or Picard? All the big questions.
All the big questions.
Questions that matter most.
Right. I was coming home the other day from my father's house. We went to my dad's house in Virginia. And on the way back, we had to stop off in that massive madhouse called the Atlanta Airport. And I was listening to the music while we were waiting for our flight. I was listening to the music, as I am wont to do.
Tis your cross to bear.
That's right. Anyway, I was listening, and it was all Christmas music. Of course, this was just the first couple of days of December.
Yeah.
And you expect that now, even though, of course, Christmas doesn't start until the 25th. Never mind. Did I say that out loud?
No, of course not.
Did I say that? I didn't say that out loud, I hope.
You heathens out there.
Advent. But anyway, they were playing Christmas music, as is everybody's way. But I noticed that none of the tunes they were playing were very straight, what we would call in music straight. That is, for example, there are two different kinds of Christmas music, of course. They're the songs that you're used to hearing in church, you know, God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay, mm-hmm. or joy to the world, the Lord is come, those kind of texts, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's Jingle Bells, and there's Frosty the Snowman, and there's Happy Holidays.
There's sacred Christmas songs and, like, secular Christmas songs.
There you go. But what I found was this. None of them, including the more sacred ones, were ever played straight. Okay. You didn't hear, you know, a boy choir singing the straight God rest ye merry gentlemen, or whatever. It was always a kind of jazz combo with a saxophone and doing it a real do do dee do ba do da da
ba. So when you say they don't play it, they don't play it straight, you mean they don't play it like a form mashing content kind of thing?
Well, that or just it's that they are taking a familiar tune. And they're emptying it of any kind of meaning. Mm-hmm. And then because it's familiar, they're playing it. Everybody will recognize the tune. But they're doing it in a kind of jazzy, smoky kind of, you know, way that it separates the meaning of the thing from the form of it.
Gotcha.
Anyway, it struck me that way when I was listening to those. I thought, if you're going to play Christmas music, why can't we just listen to it straight? Why can't we make it as you might have originally heard it, you know, performed, or it performed in a way where the content and the form go together? And it occurred to me that it was part of a larger system of kind of, I don't want to say cynicism exactly, but it's a distancing from meaning somehow. It's a nod and a wink to the traditions instead of actually practicing a tradition.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, if you jazz up O Holy Night, I mean, the lyrics and the depth of the music in O Holy Night is like deeply and profoundly theological. But if you just do like lounge musicify it, it's almost like you can listen to it and not listen to it, like, at the same time. So yeah, it creates that distance. You don't really have to deal with it, even though it's there. It makes no obligations upon you.
Right. Now, yeah, and that's part and parcel of the whole sort of Muzak world, right? It's supposed to be background music. It's supposed to be what I think Brian Eno called atmospheric music, or Anyway, it was. It's not intended to be listened to.
Yeah.
So I'm abusing it probably by actually paying attention to it. But it dawned on me that it was. I mean, I'm not even saying, hey, they weren't taking Christmas seriously. That's not my point at all. Mm-hmm. It has to do with taking anything seriously.
Yeah.
You know, anything like Bill Murray's famous lounge lizard routine from Saturday Night Live, where he'd go, "Star Wars, nothing but Star Wars, yeah. Ray guns and spaceships flying around." Hey. And it's the same thing, right? I'm not arguing that we ought to be taking Star Wars seriously theologically or something. I'm just saying that the original thing is one knowing element in our culture. But what Murray was comically doing was jazzing it up and taking away, sort of erasing its depth and meaning, and just riffing, as it were, like a jazz musician does, mm-hmm. on the surface of the meaning.
Yeah.
You see? And then the meaning, of course, in this case, is just that it's a tune everybody knows.
Yeah, well, I mean, you said it's not exactly cynicism, but I think cynicism is connected to it. It's a desire not to take anything seriously. It's kind of a desire. To not take anything seriously implies that you don't think there's anything serious. Like there's nothing.
Okay. Yeah.
There's not actually anything profound there anyway, which is a very cynical view of existence. So why not take, you know, Christmas carols that are just profoundly theological and just basically make them Muzak? I mean, why not? I mean, why not? Why not take Star Wars, which is based, you know, back when I guess when that SNL riff was happening, it was the original trilogy, which is basically just a recapitulation of Joseph Campbell's hero myth, right? The great monomyth, and for goodness sake. Like, let's just take that and just sort of like, you know, should not act like we actually enjoy it, even if we do enjoy it. It's this weird sense of distancing ourselves from it and acting like, oh, it's like the dwarves in The Last Battle, you know? It's like there's those dwarves that The Last Battle, I'm talking about the Chronicles of Narnia, for those who weren't following me there. In the last battle, when like everything's done and the false Aslan is gone and all that stuff happens and everyone goes into like real Narnia, there's these dwarves that are in real Narnia, but they want to act like they're still in a tool shed.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about? And one of the things they keep saying to themselves every time people try to tell them, "You're actually in real Narnia, don't you see it?" is they keep telling themselves, "Don't be taken in."
Yes.
You know, it's like,
I'm not going to be taken in by that.
Right. Is this
foolishness.
Is this refusal to be taken in by anything.
Duped.
You know, because there's a sense of you're like duped, you're like, you're being duped, or you're a sucker. If you take something seriously, if you take something sincerely, like you sincerely enjoy it, then somehow you're a sucker, you're a dupe, you're naive, you're a kid, you're whatever. And so there has... And so it's a way of, like, divesting things of a kind of depth and profundity. So you can just sort of stand apart from it and act like it doesn't matter. You know, that's basically what it does. Like, it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. Oh, Holy Night has no bearing on me because it's just Muzak in the background.
But it's a tune that I know, mm-hmm. and so I can have a kind of tangential reference point like that, a superficial, tangential kind of connection to the past without actually buying into being duped, being taken in like the dwarves. Yeah, that's the idea. That's kind of what I was thinking as I listened to this music. And, I mean, we have a society to a great degree that is more and more comfortable with that, I think. Mm-hmm. In the 50s and 60s, early 60s anyway, there was still a sense that you could be unironically sincere about things, about life, and after the 60s, I think it became more difficult to be. You were too sophisticated. You're too knowing. You're too too aware of how things fall apart. About how things that look sincere on the front turn out to be fake or foolishness. And I think the whole advertising world has kind of brought us to that level too. We kind of are tired of being sold to, tired of being promoted to. Hey, here's the latest thing, the best thing, it's going to make your life perfect. And we've seen it so many times fall apart that we don't we don't buy it anymore.
Yeah, irony is kind of the essence of the postmodern condition in a way.
Right.
So like in narrative, irony is basically when what is expected is basically the antithesis of what actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Macbeth hears that no man of woman born will kill Macbeth. And what he expects that means is nobody can kill him because everybody's born. But then what actually happens is Macduff was not born. He was like cesarean sectioned out.
Right,
and
right.
Oh no, it's like I didn't anticipate that.
Him.
And so like what he actually thought was going to happen, the exact opposite happens. And it's ironic. And so the irony implies in it the sort of disjointment between expectations and reality. And so for postmodernism, and a postmodern like stance is one of irony toward existence, which means you know what the expectations are, but you know what the reality is. You know the disjointment between them. So you know that, like, I don't know, a Superman movie, like, posits some sort of image of goodness and heroism and truth, justice, and the American way. But you, cool, smart, hip, and groovy, probably college-educated person that you are, know otherwise. You know what reality is.
Yeah.
You know that it doesn't line up with truth and justice, and that the American way is capitalist, patriarchal, oppressive, so on and so forth. So, to live ironically means you live aware that all expectations, all like, you know, what is put out there is like, this is what's right, this is what's true, this is what's good, this is what's beautiful, don't actually match up with reality. And thus to enjoy something, there's this weird phenomenon of enjoying something ironically.
That's right. Yeah, I see it in a lot of my younger colleagues where they'll have an Elvis clock, you know, and instead of a pendulum swinging back and forth, it has his two legs, like at the hips, swinging back and forth, you know. And I would think it's kind of tacky, but they think, I can enjoy this ironically, you see. And they actually find some enjoyment in it.
Right. It's aware that it's tacky.
That's right. I'm layers ahead of you, in other words, you know.
Or like you can't watch something without, you know, making a crack about how stupid it is, but you still watch it or something like that. And you watch it because it's stupid. You know, like a phenomenon of like actually enjoying terrible movies.
Oh yes,
you know,
right.
Like legitimately terrible movies, not movies that were like B level but still had some entertainment value. I mean things like Troll 2.
A great bad movie.
Or the Room or something like that. I mean, Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is a fantastic show and does not endorse this podcast in any way, shape, or form, is like it could not exist if it didn't exist in that sort of ironic culture.
Right.
You know, that just like enjoys sort of acknowledging that the expectation was one way, but the reality went the other way. And so it's just to be in the postmodern condition is basically to believe you're smarter than everyone else.
There is a kind of arrogance built into it.
Oh, yes, very much so. Very pretentious.
I'm smarter than you are because I don't get duped. I'm like the dwarves. I don't get duped. But what we're seeing in the last couple of decades is something called the new sincerity, which is a bit of an argument back the other way, isn't it? I know you're writing your PhD thesis on literary criticism, and even one of your faculty members, I remember you mentioning, said had some questions about postmodernism that maybe it wasn't all that it was cracked up.
Yeah, one of my faculty members who will remain unnamed to protect their safety. Literary theory in the university for the last like 20 or 30 years is basically just some kind of weird combination of Marxist and postmodern philosophy. That's basically
Saussure and Derrida. Yeah, and
that's basically all it is. It doesn't exactly teach you how to read literature. It teaches you how to see through literature.
Right.
Right. It teaches you the ironic position to recognize that the literature is a form of representation. That's like a good old Platonic way of describing it. It's a form of representation, and those representations put forth some sort of expectation, let's say, that the good guys always win, or that, you know, the good people are beautiful people or something like that. You know, the princess is the prettiest and like the evil witch is like ugly. I'm being very cliche here, right?
Sure, sure.
But it puts forth certain expectations, and then your job is to basically show how those expectations don't line up with the real world, right? They don't line up with reality, the physical world. Or you're to look at a piece of art or a piece of literature, a piece of representation, and show how it itself actually subverts, you know, expectations and shows how they don't actually work. So maybe it's an ironic work. It's a postmodern piece of writing or something like that.
Right.
So one of my professors who was really into that stuff said, you know, he came of age academically in the 80s, and that was like the heyday of deconstruction, which is sort of the catch-all term for that kind of ironic seeing through of things. And he said when he was growing up into that and came out of graduate school, he was a die-hard deconstructionist. He just was like, he thought it was the greatest thing. It was good. It was the future, everything. But now, like when I came to graduate school and sat under their tutelage, their attitude was more, they're not sure anymore. Because it feels like the thing, the way they described it is, it feels like the thing's gotten in a rut and just doesn't know where else to go.
Well, it's a little like Lewis when he says, if you see through one thing in order to see something else, well, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. Like through a window to see the yard beyond. But if the garden or the yard beyond, too, is transparent, then what do you see when you see through things? If you, in other words, if you see through everything, it's the same thing as being blind, he would say.
And it's sort of as
so there has to be something there eventually to look at.
Right.
And, of course, that is usually an ideology. It's something like we're going to reinterpret Shakespeare from a feminist perspective or from a Marxist perspective or something.
Right. So the dominant sort of attitude intellectually for a lot of people was this sort of irony. And that irony that created cynicism. Because remember, if you're in the ironic mood, so to speak, you're smarter than everyone else.
Right.
Everyone else is a sucker. Everyone else is a sheep. Everyone else is benighted. But you clearly see the plague of fantasies that liberal capitalist democracy has thrown up in front of you. This is always about capitalism being the bad guy in some way.
Or patriarchy.
Or patriarchy or whatever. Or capitalist patriarchy or whichever. Like, whatever. Like or imperialist.
Let's put them all together.
Heteronormative, capitalist, imperialist, patriarchal, cisgender ableism. Just put it all together. And nativism.
You're going to run out of hyphens.
You know what? I don't even know what to call it anymore.
There's a finite number of hyphens in the world.
At some point. At some point, though, it's like people, I don't know why they didn't realize this sooner, but at some point people started to realize you can't stay there.
Right.
Like, you just can't stay in that position of seeing through everything ironically and cynically for no other reason than it's just absolutely exasperating and exhausting at some point. And also, people kick against it. Like, they just kick against it. You come to them and you tell them that you enjoy X. I don't know what X is. You know, Star Wars, right? You only enjoy Star Wars because you're bought into, like, mass consumerism, or you've bought into the monomyth, which is fascist, so you're a crypto-fascist or something like that. Apparently all hero stories are basically shibboleths for fascism. It's like that's the only reason you like it, and people, educated or not, kick against that. They're like, no, that's not why I like it. There's something good about the Jedi. There's something good about John Wayne, you know, in one of his cowboy movies. There's something bad about Maleficent, you know, in Sleeping Beauty. There's something true that's there. There was something truly beautiful. There was something truly good. And their antithesis, you know, there was something truly evil, or there was something truly false.
When we talk about fiction, when we talk about fiction, we're actually talking about the truth. Mm-hmm. Because fiction has to tell the truth. I know it sounds like a contradiction in terms, but the fiction part of it is the story that's made up. But it's a story that's made up. If it's going to ring and be successful, if it's going to ring true, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. That the characters are true to themselves, and that the situation resonates with a truth beyond itself. There's a real purpose to fiction, and it's to tell the truth.
Right, and even the ironic position doesn't get away from that, because the whole ironic position is that there's expectation and reality, right? And the only way you can critique the expectation is if you believe there's a reality that it doesn't line up with. But then that's, like you said, that's where the ideology comes in. Well, what is reality? Well, reality is this thing. But even their explanation of reality doesn't seem good enough.
So the whole postmodern idea of rejecting meta-narratives is this idea of rejecting that reality, but they can't help but come up with a new meta-narrative, it seems to me.
Yeah.
One that says, well, that nothing is a meta narrative.
Yeah.
So you're stuck with it's like saying I'm not going to read nothing. I'm going to read something. It's a question of whether I read bad books or good books.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to have some kind of a there. It's just a question of which there I'm going to put in that place.
Yeah.
So I can understand a little of the reaction of honest people against a kind of complete cynicism, because eventually they, you know, people want to be able to enjoy something.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, my dinner, you know, whatever. I want to be able to enjoy something.
Right.
And I can't live without that completely, even though I say there isn't anything out there that's worth enjoying or putting my heart into, as it were.
Right.
Because you can be so easily duped.
Yeah. The people need to understand that, like, there's the irony part and the cynicism of it. But the reality that they try to put forward, they say there's a disjointment between expectation and reality. The reality, so like, that kind of leaves nothing, because then all your books and all your stories are all just kind of meaningless, or they're all illusions hiding something else. But then the thing that they're hiding, the reality, is just not worth talking about in some ways, or it just feels really ugly and awful. Like, well, the reality is this massive oppressive system, and all literature and all art is basically either affirming it or subverting it, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't see mm-hmm. that, if you sit there and are actually enjoying the idea of knights slaying dragons, well, you're right. Just a poor little child who doesn't understand the real world like the rest of us do.
Yeah.
So it's like irony and cynicism and arrogance just all sort of rolled up in one thing. And at some point, people just get sick of it. They're just tired. They're just tired of it. And one of the first people to express that sort of exhaustion, interesting, ironically enough, see what I did there? In the early 90s, 1993, David Foster Wallace is sort of the poster child for postmodern literature. He is like one of the popularizers of hypertext, which is like you write a story, but then you write footnotes to the story that are like the author talking about, now here's why I did this, or why am I frustrated with this character?
Yeah.
So it's again, ironic detachment. It's like, there's the expectation, which is the story, but then there's reality, the author trying to work it out, right?
Yeah, commenting on
it. Right, I mean, he's like a poster child for postmodern irony. And in like the early 90s, and then pretty much through the latter part of his run as a writer, which is probably like the last 10 years of his life, he died in 2008, I believe, tragically killed himself.
Took his own life, yeah.
In 1993, he wrote an essay called E Unibus Plurum, I think it is, Television and U.S. Fiction. Mm-hmm. And in there, he talked about the irony and the cynicism that had been created by this postmodern, you know, idea about existence and what it had done in the arts. And he said something strange. He said, well, he says a lot of strange things, but one of the strange things he said was that he believed that the postmodern times were rebels because they risk disapproval, right? Because that's what a rebel does. They risk disapproval.
Yeah.
You know, they risked shock and outrage and the gasp as they refuse to take seriously the things they're supposed to take seriously. You know, they don't take Shakespeare seriously, or they don't take whomever, you know, canonical stuff seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they risk that disapproval. Wallace believed that the next rebels, he said the new rebels are going to be a bunch of weird anti-rebels, is what he called them. Mm-hmm. They're going to be people who risk disapproval, but they risk the disapproval of the ironic cynics.
In that they actually are going to take something seriously.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know what? It's such a good quote. Let me actually quote him here from that essay, because it's just such a fantastic quote.
Okay.
Always looking it up. Yeah, the essay is E Unibus Plurum, Television and U.S. Fiction. He did it in 1993. Here's the quote, and I'm going to read it at length. Well, maybe not at length, but I'm going to read the important part of it. He says, quote, "The next real literary rebels in this country might well emerge as some weird bunch of anti-rebels, born ooglers who dare somehow to back away from ironic watching, who have the childish gall actually to endorse and instantiate single entendre principles," single entendre as opposed to double entendre,
right,
which is like when something has two meanings at once. He's like, no, these are the people back away from it and have a more... He uses the word childish. It's almost like a childlike wonder at things, a childlike acceptance of things, taking it as it is. They treat plain old untrendy human troubles and emotions in U.S. life with reverence and conviction. They eschew self-consciousness and hip fatigue. These anti-rebels would be outdated, of course, before they even started. Dead on the page, too sincere, clearly repressed, backwards, quaint, naive, anachronistic, and maybe that'll be the point. Maybe that's why they'll be the next real rebels. Real rebels, as far as I can see, risk disapproval. The old postmodern insurgents risked the gasp and squeal. But today's risks are different. The new rebels might be artists willing to risk the yawn, the rolled eyes, the cool smile, the nudged ribs, and the parody of gifted ironist. To risk accusations of sentimentality, melodrama, overcredulity, softness, a willingness to be suckered by a world of lurkers and starers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The new rebels are going to be these people who sincerely enjoy things and don't care what the ironic cynics have to say about it.
I can see why human beings made in the image of God would eventually have to turn around from cynicism. Eventually, even if they're not believers in God, they'd have to believe in something.
Yes.
And I get that. But I was reading about David Foster Wallace and how he turned around and how he started undoing some of the postmodern theory that he had propounded for so long. And, of course, in the end, he did commit suicide. So it occurs to me that maybe he wasn't able to connect the things up somehow. That, you know, if he were to actually find something transcendent and hold to that again, then I would think that would ground him enough and give him something to push against so that he would have traction and live his life out, you know. But to take his life, now I don't know why he did. He might have had depression, or he might have had some sort of horrible experience, you know, a divorce or a death or something that has caused him that, and there was a momentary, I don't have any idea why he did it.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking that, I'm thinking about the larger picture of this postmodernism turn to the new sincerity, if we can call it that, if that's what people are calling it.
Mm-hmm.
And wondering if it's a return to transcendence, or is it an extension of this kind of individual experiential kind of thing that's just guided in a sense by the human need for something to be there.
Yeah, that's what this new sincerity thing to me seems to present is not so much an explanation or even a good counter argument against postmodern cynicism and irony, but more like an open opportunity for those of us who are tired of or who just flatly disagree with postmodern irony and cynicism, an opportunity for us to step in and give a better explanation for things.
Uh-huh.
Because the new sincerity is basically the declaration of a kind of intuitive sense that the cynical posture towards everything is not good enough. That somehow you just can't stay there forever, that you have to affirm something. I mean, the whole social justice movement rises up because that's, you can almost say, and this is like why I say it's an opportunity and a danger, because you can almost say why social justice seems to just have surged in the last 10 years or, you know, even less, is because they're trying to affirm something, right? They're trying to affirm justice as a value that's real and that's true and that's, you know, whatever, you know, however they want to put it. Maybe they don't articulate it very well, but it's the sense of like we have to affirm something as real. We have to put something there that we think is true and actually can animate us and give us meaning and direction. There's great opportunity there because maybe, you know, back in the past, the way I put it is this way. It's like what the new sincerity should do for like Christians particularly is help them understand where they are in culture, or where culture is, what the actual battlefield is.
Mm-hmm.
I know like in politics and certain cultural domains, people talk about we have to get rid of what they call a Cold War mentality, which is like there's still some policies and political philosophies that are still built like the Cold War is going on when things have changed. It's the same kind of idea. It's like you got to recognize where's the actual battle, what are the actual risks, what are the actual dangers.
Sure.
And there's an opportunity here because people are starting to say, or at least they're starting to feel more comfortable with saying and feeling what they've always said and felt, that this kind of cynicism and irony and this sort of seeing through everything is just not good enough. Like, it's just not. Mm-hmm. And we see, I mean, there's lots of examples I could give, and I don't know if I want to take the time to unpack them or not, just things like The Office.
Well, I was going to say, there's an article, actually a blog that I was reading about David Foster Wallace and his thoughts, mm-hmm. and compared Leave It to Beaver from the 50s with Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And then Seinfeld with The Office.
Yes. Seinfeld is definitely cynical irony.
Yeah, where actually nothing ever happens.
Yeah, no one changes. No things are put forward. There's no progression. It's a complete subversion of like the sitcom model in many ways.
And with Leave It to Beaver, or others like it at the time, the end of the 50s and so on.
Father Knows Best,
yeah. Even the Dick Van Dyke Show, which I like a lot. Mm-hmm. But there's a sincerity there that's completely unironic.
Yeah.
There's, you know, Beaver's problem, this 30-minute television show's problem is going to be something like, you know, the difficulty of a boy who threw his baseball accidentally through a window and has to address it and go and see the neighbor and tell him so. And
yeah.
You know what I mean? But it was never ironic about it. It was always, it was taken for granted that this is life, this is how things go, and that there really is a sort of moral universe in which these things happen.
Yeah.
But with Seinfeld, all that is taken away. The funny thing about The Office is that it, on the surface, it is the perfect ironic detachment, because it's a television show about somebody making a television show about something that's basically meaningless.
Yeah.
Right? This office is selling paper products.
At a time when, like, digital, e-readers and stuff are probably starting to come around and destroy
the market. Nobody buys paper anymore, seriously, right. Like that. So the whole thing seems to be not just a meaningless point to a plot, but a documentary about a meaningless thing that I'm now sitting and watching.
Yes. So it's just layered, yeah.
And yet at the same time, there are relationships in that engagement that are not meaningless.
Yeah, like The Office is like considered one of the prime examples of this sort of like new sincerity worked out in the sitcom world. Because if on the surface, like I said, it's a show about a show about something that's completely pointless. Also, Jim and Dwight are like the two sort of opposite ends of the pole here. Jim is like the personification of like ironic trollery, mm-hmm, all right? Mm-hmm. And Dwight is just the personification of sincerity. Mm-hmm. He takes paper selling seriously, and his farm seriously, and his shrewd ways, his identity of as a family seriously, man. Angela,
his taking it seriously, though, is part of the, I mean, popping that sincerity is the running gag of the show.
Yeah, like Jim is constantly trolling him and making fun of him and just kind of doing this sort of what looks like ironic sort of, look how silly this all is.
Putting his prize stapler in Jell-O.
Yeah.
It's hysterical.
In the show itself, sometimes takes those pot shots because Dwight is kind of ridiculous with his shrewdness and his rigorous shrewd traditions and all this jazz. Mm-hmm. So it's all set up to just be incredibly ironic and detached and do the whole cynicism thing. And yet there's this, at the center of the show, is this deep sort of appreciation for the sincerity. You know, there's like
at least in that one romance.
Yeah, there's that. There's Jim and Pam.
Right.
For goodness sake, I mean, it's like one of the great TV romances of all time. Is like Jim and Pam, and their relationship and them coming together is taken very seriously. Like, there's no attempt to try and ironically detach yourself or show how it actually like ruins things or is actually not as fairy tale as it is. You know, in the end, like Pam says, it wasn't exactly fairy tale, but it wasn't fairy tale in the sense that we actually worked at it and we had to struggle with it, but in struggling with it, it became stronger and more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
even their attempt to say it wasn't a fairy tale is them just affirming that actually it was better than, not uh-huh. worse or less uh-huh. than. So I know there was like a YouTube video where somebody unpacked an example of this from The Office where Andy, who is like another character who's just absolute pure sincerity. Like, he just takes things way too seriously, or takes himself, the Nard Dog, way too seriously. And Jim, of course, just loves to, you know, burst his bubble too. And there's a sequence in one episode where Andy thinks that, like, Jim and Pam's relationship is off to a bad start because Andy got burned in a relationship once. And Jim knows that Andy's being ridiculous, but instead of telling him you're being ridiculous, he decides to show him by trolling him, by taking him and his concerns really seriously. And in the process of taking his concerns really seriously, made Andy look like a fool in front of everybody.
Wow.
But that's not where the episode ends. Like, there's a moment where Andy realizes he's been made a fool of by Jim, the great, you know, ironic troll.
Yeah.
But then Andy confronts Jim to ask him why did he do that, and Jim basically turns his ironic trollery into a lesson to give hope to Andy. That he's like, look, Andy, he said, Pam and I are fine. He said, what happened to you was sad, but it's not the end of the road for you, and you're going to find somebody. There's somebody out there forever. Like, he uses it as a way to, like, teach him an old-fashioned, quote-unquote, American value that true love wins in the end.
Uh-huh.
And so suddenly the ironic deconstructing of something is actually an avenue for a sincere declaration that love is real and love is going to win, and it's not going to all end in awfulness.
Mm-hmm.
It's stuff like that. The Office does that. The Community does that. Movies like Logan and The Last Jedi do something similar. I hesitate to bring up The Last Jedi because it's, like, super controversial, but, and I'm not saying anything new about it. It's just that it cynically deconstructs something that is precious to people, but then by the end of the movie reaffirms and builds it back up.
The whole mythos of the X-Men or the mythos of the Jedi.
Yeah, like in Logan, there's literally a moment where Wolverine finds an X-Men comic and basically ridicules the little girl who, like, you know, I say little girl, she's like a deadly, like, mutant killer, but still, nonetheless, he basically, like, ridicules her for reading this stuff. He calls it garbage. Wolverine called an X-Men comic garbage. You can't get more ironically cynical than that.
And detached.
Right?
Right.
But by the end of the movie, he has to go full comic book Wolverine to save her and her friends, and he's, you know, spoilers, he, like, sacrifices himself to, like, save them. And so this new generation of mutants now is going to hold him up as an example, as, like, the one to follow. So it's like he deconstructs it, but then reaffirms it. Last Jedi is the same thing. I mean, Luke just absolutely takes all the starch out of the Jedi. You know, they were corrupt, blind, hubris who think they own the Force, and so on and so forth. And takes out all his own legend, too, right? Like, he's this legend, but he failed. But Rey is like, I still want to be a Jedi.
Right.
And it's just like, it's good to fight Snoke, and it's good to say no to Kylo Ren, who Kylo, like, totally buys into the cynical aspect of it. That's why he's, like, burned the past and all that type
of
jazz.
Right.
I think a lot of people got mad at The Last Jedi for lots of reasons, but one of the reasons they got mad at it is because it legitimately deconstructed the Jedi and Luke, which people don't want you to do.
Right, right.
And that's kind of in a roundabout way, is the new sincerity, is that there are things people don't want cynicism to touch. They just don't. And I don't think they know how to articulate why. They just know that they don't want you to touch it.
And I think you're right. I don't think they know why.
Mm-hmm.
My problem with this is that as much as I would like to think that this is a step in the right direction, I'm having trouble deciding whether it is.
Yeah.
Only because they don't understand. People just saying, well, I don't want you to undo my mythos, the reason that cynicism catches on is because there is fakery out there.
Yeah, totally.
Right? And you can be faked out. You can be duped. People can be duped, and you don't want to be. That's why you can go to the extreme of saying, well, I'm just not going to believe anything. I'm not going to be sincere about anything. I'm not going to trust anything. I remember hearing an actor, there's a line in a play, actually there's a play called The New Sincerity.
Interesting.
And it played in Chicago, played in New York, I think. And in it, one of the characters says that she's engaged to this fellow, and another character says, engaged? Do you still do that? Yeah. As though, you know, we don't need any, we don't have any sincerity about anything.
Yeah.
We don't.
Marriage is a construction of Hallmark to like sell wedding dresses or something.
You exactly. Know, like, exactly. I mean, and no matter what the tradition is, it's inherently flawed. And because of its flaw, you need to dismiss it.
It's not speaking to anything truly human.
That's right.
Right. That's the attitude. I agree with you that it's just a feeling and sort of intuition, and it's definitely marketable. I was going to also mention, Firefly is another new sincerity thing, right? They also do this kind of, Josh Whedon does that a lot. Mm-hmm. I speak his name cautiously because of recent things with him, but he's another thing that's kind of the new sincerity, or somebody called it his neo-romanticism, somebody called it. But I agree with you that I don't think the new sincerity is something that we should get all jazz and optimistic about, because I think what it is an opportunity. In opportunities, there are dangers. If people are standing there and saying, for some reason, I don't know why, and I don't know how to articulate it other than I just like it, I don't like this cynical, ironic thing, you know, when it touches this, that, or the other, or I don't like it in general. I can't articulate why, I just don't like it in general. And it's the, I don't know why, is where the opportunity and the danger is. Mm-hmm. Because anybody could step into that space and give an explanation for why. We could step in there and give an explanation. We can give a theology of beauty and a theology of the arts and explain how it's connected up to the transcendent and to the beauty of the Lord. And all, we could do all that, right?
Right.
Someone else could step in there and explain that it's all just a pure private, individual, like, thing that you like. And, you know, in reality, it's all, you know, a purely kind of secular, individualist kind of attitude. Well, we know it's all garbage, but we also know that it does good for you. So you know what? We'll just let you believe it. It's kind of like a secular, individualist attitude towards religion.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
It's like, it's nice if you want to go to your church and it makes you a good person. Awesome. It's still garbage and not true, but if you want to believe it, that's fine. That's another explanation someone can give, and that's not a good explanation. So there's an opportunity here, but opportunities also can be dangers.
Well, I think that's, Camus actually wrote this way. So this is not a new idea.
Yeah.
About how there's such a thing as a sort of existential. People use that word, by the way, existential, all the time to mean present or real or something like that. But there's a philosophical meaning to existentialism that is an assumption of nihilism. We know that there's nothing that's meaningful.
Yes.
But existentialism would say, I'm going to believe in something anyway. Yes. And it sounds a little bit like this new sincerity to me.
Right.
It's not that I actually believe there's something there. Down deep inside, I hold that there isn't anything there.
Yeah.
But I can't live there. Nobody can live in nihilism.
Yeah.
And so the existentialist would say, I'm going to believe in... there's so many options.
I know, right?
Yeah, I can't pick one that would satisfy. But if you just read the plague, read the plague. And there's a plague. I'll tell you the basic plot real fast. It's about this city in Africa that has a plague that hits it, and everybody leaves town except those that are infected and those few that stay for other reasons. And knowing that everybody is basically going to die, there's no cure for the plague. Mm-hmm. The question is then, how do you find meaning in your life knowing that you're going to die?
Right.
And of course, it's a big metaphor for everybody's life because everybody's going to die, right? Whether you have the plague or not, you're going to die of old age. But in the plague, he has all these different, or in the story of the plague, he has all these different characters finding meaning in their own, each of their own ways. And one of them, for example, decides, I am going to every day count out a certain number of peas and eat them. Mm-hmm. That's my meaning in life. That's where I'm going to find meaning.
Yeah.
There's a priest who continues to practice the Mass, continues to practice Christian principles without believing any of them. But he, in a sense, is existentially believing in Christianity anyway.
Yeah.
Right? So, and I don't find either of those satisfying.
No.
And I'm convinced, I'm concerned that what might be called a new sincerity isn't necessarily a going back to an honest principle where you have a transcendent reality that you truly believe.
It would just be existentialism in another guise.
It seems like it to me.
Yeah, that's why I agree with you, because that's why my dissertation is not about the new sincerity, but it's connected to it. And the argument I would give my dissertation is probably what I would say to the new sincerity. And that is, if you want to legitimately move forward, you have to abandon nihilism. Like, you have to. You can't just affirm privately and personal, well, I think this matters,
or I happen to like it. I like this thing, and I'm going to like it. I'm going to bravely like it, even if people roll their eyes at me.
Right. No.
Well,
the only way actually forward is to abandon nihilism, and the thing to affirm is not I like this, that, or the other. The thing to affirm is that no, to put it in one way, truth, beauty, and goodness with a capital T, B, and G exist and are knowable.
Right.
Like that's what has to happen. That's what has to happen. And that's, for me, that's why there's an opportunity, because the new sincerity is like an and it's one we have to take seriously, because like I said, there's dangers. Like a more existentialist sort of attitude, a sort of secularist, individualist attitude could step in there and just say, yes, like find meaning in it. Part of me wonders if that would even be successful, because people are so exhausted with cynicism that I feel like there may be even greater opportunity for them for transcendent things, like an affirmation of truth, beauty, and goodness.
Yeah.
I think there is actually an opening for that to have a hearing again.
Uh-huh.
Because
that
people
would be great.
Because there's already people who are still stuck in sort of the cynical nihilistic mode who are arguing that, like, well, yes, if you personally find it meaningful, well, hey, I mean, don't worry about my cynical deconstruction of it. There are people out there like that. But I feel like that response is going to be there. But there's part of me, I could be wrong about this, but part of me suspects that response is not going to be good enough anymore because we've heard it before.
Well, I think it's part and parcel of that whole postmodern theory, because it used to be, I used to teach my students that you can tell the difference between a modernist and a postmodernist when you go up to them and shake their hands and say, hi, I'm a Christian, I believe in Jesus Christ. The modernist will say, what, have you lost your mind? Mm-hmm. What's the matter with you? Why don't you put all that foolish, superstitious nonsense away? Let's go back to the laboratory and we'll figure it all out scientifically. You don't have any room for that.
Yeah.
But if you say the same thing to a postmodernist, he'll say, oh, I'm so happy for you. You see, you found something that works for you. I'm into tea leaves myself, but I'm really glad you found something that works for you. The kind of a new tribalism, of individualism, hyper-individualism, and a kind of each of us finding his own way in his own time and so on.
Yes.
And that, and neither of those is very very satisfying. But the Christian can agree with both of them to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
That is, agree with the modernist in the sense that he says there is a truth to be found.
Yes.
Right? But you can agree with the postmodernist in saying that there are limits to our ability to know these things.
Right.
This absolute surety kind of thing that the modernist has been saying can only be found in the laboratory or in the material world is a dead end. I get that. Now, yeah. I'm just trying to figure if this new sincerity is actually just more of that kind of postmodernism, individualistic, experiential liking of things that leads to a sort of tribalism and a kind of existential dismissal of real what Schaefer used to call true truth.
Yeah.
Not just truth for me, but true truth. Dismissal of that. It may be that there's an end of the cynical road here, a dead end of postmodernism, but the new sincerity may very well continue it in some way without actually returning to anything profound. However, I'm with you. I think that every time there's a question mark, any time there's a corner to be turned, there's an opportunity to speak the truth and as you say, the goodness and the beautiful to the watching world, because there's a hunger for something.
Yeah, I believe what you're detecting is the fact that this new sincerity is still a product of a postmodern world, in a way.
That's what I'm concerned about.
It is grown out of it. It's not like it came from the outside. The new sincerity is not like a bunch of random like alien invaders landed and say, we believe in true truth or something like that.
Right.
The new sincerity is basically postmodernist running out of steam, right? Uh-huh. It's postmodern fatigue, right? Which is why, again, quite frankly, Logan and The Last Jedi are two great examples, because both of them, even though they reaffirm, you know, the X-Men, or they reaffirm the myth of Wolverine, they reaffirm the legend of the Jedi and Luke Skywalker, they still initially have to go through their paces of the cynical, deconstructive thing. And they don't exactly refute it. It's not like the Jedi weren't a bunch of corrupt, you know, mm-hmm. hubristic mm-hmm. jerks. It's not like the comics of the X-Men that Logan doesn't like weren't inaccurate. So it's not like, it's like it doesn't disagree with the cynicism exactly. It just has this feeling that the cynicism is missing something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an outgrowth of the postmodern thought, which means there's probably a postmodern-y explanation that might satisfy some people, which is that kind of that existentialist, hyper-individualist sort of thing. Well, if you personally like it, then, well, I guess we should leave it alone. But at the same time, I feel like because cynicism has run its course so much, there are some people who are, it's not the cynicism they're tired of. If they could articulate it, they would say it's the nihilism they're getting tired of. And I think that's the difference. I think that it's not just simply existentialism reasserting itself, because we already did that before with Camus and everyone else saying that, well, this is what we got to do, got to assert your own private meaning. Right. I think people might be getting exhausted of that too. It's like, no, this isn't my meaning. Jim and Pam their relationship doesn't just mean something to me. It is truly a romantic and good thing, and if you don't believe that, then there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That attitude, that's like...
That would be encouraging, if that really were what was happening.
I've said this to you before, that like this marks nerd culture in a lot of way. You know, if you go to like a comic convention, like sometimes I go to Dragon Con, you know, there's panels there that are all about, like, the deconstruction of whatever, or, like, Afrocentricism in Captain America or something like that. I don't know. It's like all the usual academic, ironic, postmodern, seeing through, and then trying to posit an ideology.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You can do all that stuff, but there's a limit to it, because if you start to, I don't know, ironically postmodern Steven Universe or something like that to a Steven Universe fan, they're going to get mad at you, and they don't want you to touch it. Because they somehow think it's, you can't touch this. This is not something you can deconstruct. This has something in it that is true and good, and it's not just me. I feel like you should recognize it as well. That's why I'm mad at you for trying to deconstruct it. Again, that's an opportunity.
So it's not just taking away from somebody his
private
ideology.
Little thing. I mean, some people may try to explain it that way.
Yeah, okay.
But there's almost this instinct that, no, it's not that I like it, it's that there is actually something here worth liking.
Well, what I find, to support your point, what mm-hmm. I find is that even in these stories that we've mentioned, like in The Office or in Logan or in this Jedi, Last Jedi movie, eventually you have something that's bedrock. That mm-hmm. is, the relationship between Jim and Pam is one that is that transcends them. It's a human interaction, and there's something about romance that, frankly, is part and parcel of most every human being's life.
Yeah.
And so there is a kind of not just a tribal relationship to it. I happen to like it, and you happen to like it, so we can be together in our enjoyment of this thing. But a kind of human interaction there that transcends the postmodernism of it all. The same thing in Logan, as you said, he has to actually come to a life and death situation where he has to be courageous. He has mm-hmm. to be put his character into practice and sacrifice himself for the benefit of somebody else.
Yeah.
Well, in doing that, you're not just saying, I happen to like this. If the point is, if that were all he was doing, it wouldn't be a profound moment in the film.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the Jedi thing. Here's Luke that actually comes back and saves the day at the last minute, right?
Right.
Because he is he's Luke, after all. He's not just right. somebody who's dismissed Luke. He actually is this person. And so in life and death situations, in very serious concerns like love and death, in a sense, this bedrock reality that's the truth that I was saying, it comes out in fiction, rears its head, right? It comes up. You begin to see it. And the funny thing is, the movies wouldn't be satisfying, the TV show wouldn't be satisfying if it didn't have that. Yeah. I'm always confused about why it is that Seinfeld was as popular as it was.
Yeah.
And we could talk about that another time. But what I'm saying is, in these other places, we're saying those things actually, they can't sustain their cynicism. I'm thinking about, Ecclesiastes. Go through the book of Ecclesiastes, and here is Solomon undoing everything, basically. He's saying, I've tried this, it doesn't make sense. I've tried this, it's foolishness. I've tried that over there, I've even done it so much that nobody else can do it better.
Right. Cynical irony in scripture, basically.
Basically what it is. Right. But he doesn't leave it there. I've run into people who claimed to be atheists and told me that they were atheists because of Ecclesiastes. And I say, well, did you read the very end of it? And they say, well, what does it say at the end? Because they didn't read it all.
Well, of course not.
And I said, well, at the end, he actually says, there is meaning. There is something. And now he doesn't spell it all out, every detail of your life, but he says, do the work you've been given and fear the Lord. Actually have awe for him. He's your touchstone. He's the place where things actually become meaningful again.
Yeah.
Well, that's a profound thing, and it doesn't pull any punches about its cynicism.
Yeah, it's like the cynicism without the nihilism.
But it's not nihilistic, end.
I think that's probably, if the new sincerity, and there's other things that are like connected to it that are expressing the same thing, if the new sincerity, the kind of opportunity I think it is not just simply an exhaustion with cynicism. I think it may, in fact, be, again, I don't know if people are articulating it this way yet, but it may actually be an exhaustion with nihilism, with the idea that, because if it's just an exhaustion with cynicism but not with nihilism, well, that could just go back to the Sisyphusian, you know, I find meaning pushing the boulder up the hill or something like that.
Right.
Or a sort of absurdist attitude where you can learn how to laugh at the meaninglessness of it. But if it's an exhaustion of the nihilism, if it's an exhaustion with people who would want to, you know, have Pam and Jim's relationship end with them realizing that they're actually both terrible people and they get divorced.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, the show actually kind of flirts with that just a little bit in a weird way.
Hmm.
Oh my gosh. That's not what the show does. Great, now I'm stuck on this. That's not what the show does. Like, if the show was really being cynical, if it was really still in there, then Jim and Pam would have gotten divorced when they did. People who watched the show know there was a part in, like, later seasons where their marriage got strained because of, like, a business venture Jim was going on. But there's this moment, and this probably is why I feel like the new sincerity is an opening that's something maybe we should get excited about. I don't know. But if I could summarize it, there's this moment where that danger of them getting divorced and everything ending in the cynical nihilism of it gets refuted when Jim is about to go off. His like business venture is outside of Scranton. It's like way down in Philadelphia. So he always has to fly off to go there, and it's putting a strain on his relationship because Pam is left home with like the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim seems more focused on his job than his marriage. And there's a moment where he's about to leave in a cab and she's out there like sending him off, and he turns around and he hugs her and he tells her that he knows this is really hard and he knows this is really tough, but somehow we're going to make it through.
Hmm.
And there's a moment where she sits there and she won't return the hug. Like, he hugs her, but she just kind of stands there limply because she's feeling like there's nothing left.
Hmm.
And while she stands there, she suddenly remembers back to their wedding, the preacher during their wedding reading 1 Corinthians 13.
Oh,
saying, love
no
is
kidding.
Love is patient, love is kind, it endures all things.
Wow.
It believes all things and it hopes all things. And the greatest of these, you know, faith, hope, love is love. And it's while that verse is playing, you cut back to Pam and she returns Jim's hug.
Unbelievable.
And after that moment, like in the next episodes after that, their marriage is restabilized. Because and Jim stops working at the thing, like cuts down on how much he works at that distance job, and their marriage gets saved.
Wow!
And it gets saved because love is real, like it's true. It has a transcendent reality, so it has actual substance to it.
Yes.
So I think what the New Sincerity is pointing at. Well, I don't know if like the people who talk about it understand this or not yet, but I think with the New Sincerity and why I think it's probably an opportunity we should very much take advantage of is I think it's an exhaustion with nihilism.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it were an exhaustion of nihilism, I'd be all in favor of it. And especially if it turns so blatantly to a Christian take. Yeah. I'm all for them becoming Christians. But what I'm saying is, it surprises me when a television show like that, that has been so distant in so many other ways, would take openly go to the scriptures to find hope. That's what she was looking for. She was hoping, she was allowing herself to hope that what he said, that things are going to work out, really would work out. It was an application of a very old verse. Surprises me greatly, but it says just the opposite of what I've been saying I'm concerned about. It actually calls on something that is transcendent and not just existentially.
Yes.
You know?
I agree.
Now, here's the funny thing about atheistic existentialism. Mm-hmm. The funny thing about atheistic existentialism is that sometimes it's a pathway to real faith.
Yeah.
And I think God is just kind enough to, if you're willing to take half a step toward him in that way, he will melt the nihilism away and take that little bit and that little spark and fan it into flames and have it become a real thing.
Yeah, even if your attitude towards it is a Sisyphean kind of, I'm just pushing up the boulder, even though I know everything is meaningless. It is if I could put it this way, it is a dangerous thing to allow yourself to believe something has meaning.
Yes.
Because that's almost, that little flickering ember is almost enough.
Yeah.
That's just enough for the winds to blow and to light a fire.
It's the glory of God that he doesn't require that we have all of our theological and philosophical pieces in place before he's willing to accept us. Yeah. Isn't that marvelous?
Yes.
Thanks be to God. We don't have to have it together. But what he's willing to do is fan any flame that we can, any spark that we can get going. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope and let's pray that we can make use of this particular opening in the culture for his glory, and that the truth and the true, the good and the beautiful will actually, as they always do, make themselves potently available for anybody who would turn to them.
Yes. Recommendations.
Well, I think, at the risk of sounding silly, I think.
Oh, risk it. Risk the cool smiles and the rolling eyes.
That's right. Well, at the risk of that, I'd say let's go back and reread Ecclesiastes.
Yes.
And especially the last two chapters of it, but all of it, in order to see. It's another example of how the Bible really deals with the truth flat on, full force. No holds barred, no holding back, you know. You can't get any more honest and clear than the scriptures do. And perhaps nowhere other than, in dealing with cynicism, nowhere other than, better than in Ecclesiastes. Mm-hmm. I can't say these things without bumping into all of my syllables.
That's okay.
Nowhere better than in Ecclesiastes.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'd recommend that everybody go back and look at that again. And if you'd like to talk about it, we'd be happy to discuss it with you further, especially if you've run into things like the play that I mentioned,
The New Sincerity.
The New Sincerity.
The New Sincerity. What's the Camus play you're talking about? Is that called The Plague?
The Plague. Yeah. That's right. Albert Camus wrote The Plague. It's a short story.
For you unlearned out there, it looks like Albert Camus, but it's pronounced Albert Camus.
That's right.
I say unlearned.
And what would you like to recommend?
I say unlearned. I mean, like, ordinary people who don't have to deal with this garbage.
Oh.
that's what I mean.
Right.
Mean, you people who I envy constantly. Well, I mean, I would recommend, let's see. If you're interested in, like, more of this sort of new sincerity stuff, I would probably recommend David Foster Wallace's essay, the E Unibus Plurum thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else mm-hmm. is in there. I just know that his talk about the new rebels is in there. But checking out David Foster Wallace's essay might be a good start. There's something online called a Meta-Modernist Manifesto.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Meta-Modernism. M-E-T-A Modernism. It's another sort of variation of this. It's more of like a... David Foster Wallace was speaking in terms of like literature specifically. Meta-Modernism is kind of like a philosophic sort of attitude. It's not long. It's like one web page. It's like very short. And it's just, it's another thing. If you want to, if you're looking for places to explore this type of stuff, you can check out David Foster Wallace and like the New Sincerity, or you can check out the Meta-Modernist Manifesto and see what they have to say.
We might want to talk about that sometime because it speaks about oscillation.
Yeah.
And I was just looking at it, and it sounds like it's a kind of, well, I don't want to give away all my thoughts about it, but kind of yin and yang, pushing and pulling in the natural order of the world between sincerity and cynicism, for example, or between, any opposing powers.
Yes.
Equal imposing powers.
Well, folks, we sincerely hope that you enjoy your day today. This has been From the Center, and we will see you next time.
God bless you.